Luba Mayakiso, good morning. How are you?
Very well. How are you guys?
Yes, very good. Thanks. We're having quite an intense conversation here, and I'd love your view. We're talking about Angelo Agrisi was on Chai FM earlier this week, and I was very, very conflicted by the interview. In some ways, he distanced himself from his from the actions. He portrayed himself somewhat as being somewhat of a victim. On the other hand, he has done tremendously positive things by stepping forward and exposing corruption, and giving us the details that we couldn't have known but for his actions. And I think we do have to acknowledge that. But I'm still conflicted as to how to deal with it from a, do we forgive the guy because of what he's done in terms of the good things? Do we hold on to the past? What are your thoughts?
Howard, the challenge with that is that, it almost becomes, because he might do, let's say, a plea deal, it's almost a case of saying, people can commit wrong, but if one of you jumps forward and rolls over and spills the beans on the other guys, then you're the saint and will take out the other guys. And that for me is a problem, because I mean, he's a guy who was a go-to. So he might say, you know, Watson was the man in charge of the whole company, but the person was taking the money, giving it to people and living a comfortable life. I mean, if you look at his own testimony, he was deceiving SARS, breaking down his salary between himself and his wife. So the challenge for me is, you're not dealing with a saint, but you want the evidence that he has. So you're then asking yourself and saying, do you just, forget what he did because of the value of the information that he gives? But to me, I would step back and say, what I find strange is the man took incredibly detailed records of everything, you know, video footage and kept notes. And you almost wonder, did he always intend to do something like this, or was he just getting cover for himself? I've dealt with people in government who say, for instance, I'm being asked to, let's say, issue an order or grant a permit. I'm not satisfied that all the requirements have been met, and all the person says is to their superior, please give me an email instructing me to do X, Y, Z, and then I know I've got myself covered. Mm. But Agrisi went to great lengths to detail and keep records. So for me, I have this odd suspicion, this odd kind of worry that what was his intention to do this always, or was he just being super sensitive and with foresight in keeping information? To me, he's not a saint. The information is valuable, but I think if we let him off the hook and catch the other guys, it does set a bad precedent that you can commit all manner of atrocities and wrongs as long as you're the first guy to jump forward.
To step forward. Mike Lubo says, and I think this is very well put, forgiving is only about setting me free and allowing me to live without repressed pain and suffering. It does not mean that we ever condone the action. And it's in a nutshell, David, that's what you were saying, really.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about forgetting. It's not about saying, well, now I can erase this from my memory and if I am going to...
And not condoning it. And I think that's what I like, that what Mike has added. It doesn't mean we condone that behavior.
We don't. We're not saying, you know, listen, what he did was right. We're not saying, that there was some ill intention here. And we can be angry about it, and we need to be angry about it. But it's very much, and it's not about forgetting what he did. He clearly did a lot of things that were wrong. Again, about trying to understand our reaction to it, and one of those is: am I ready to forgive? It's not about whether he's ready to say sorry. It's really, am I ready to forgive?
But if we take this further, you could look at the whole South African history on this basis, because look at pre-94, and you look at the apartheid era and regime here in South Africa, and you could have the same approach. People can now come in and saying, well, you know, it's we've done this to rectify and that, but does that mean that pain is erased, and it doesn't mean that
Howard,
those, yes, sir.
Can I just ask that to take a step back, and I'll tell you why I struggle with this thing, with all of these corruption issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Agrizi said something very important where he said, once you start giving somebody money, essentially you bribe them. You get them accustomed to a lifestyle that they can't wean themselves off, right? And they're forever dependent on you. And that for me is the worrying thing, because whether you go to the arms deal, you go to whatever commission, you can chase the guys in prisons who essentially may have worded a contract to favor Bosasa or have given it there. But who is the real culprit? Is it the civil servant, or is it the guy who has the masses of money who can influence people? Because you almost have two people that you have to deal with very differently. And the major beneficiary is not the guys who are getting the bribes. As much as Bosasa was paying money, mm-hmm. I mean, what they were getting compared to what the company was making is minuscule. And that for me is the worry, is how do you punish the person who initiates the whole corrupt event, as opposed to the other guy who's a recipient? I'm not absolving the officials, but I'm simply saying an official may get 100,000 rand, right, to sit on a panel and sway towards somebody, but somebody else is making millions. And it is that somebody from the corporate side who's kind of driving this behavior, because as long as there's somebody willing to dish out money, there's some poor guy on the other side who's going to be influenced, mm-hmm. who this is going to be attractive.
Almost like a drug
dealer. And I think it's very different how you deal with those two.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I mean, I guess we could say cynically that we do deal with them differently. Shabir Sheikh went to prison, but Jacob Zuma didn't.
That's the thing.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. I'd love your thoughts. 34519 or 0618951019. It is complex, and it does stretch us to try and understand and try and figure out how we should be dealing with these. Oh, I don't know where that's all coming from. It's very nice. Is that on your side?
Nope.
Okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, but it just seems to be a bit of a gremlin in the system. Anyway, the question is, you know, so how, David, what do we do? And I imagine it's the same question even in personal relationships. A couple is married, and there's infidelity on the part of a partner, and they come forward and say, look, you know, I'm telling you what happened. It's in the past. You know, I need you to let's move forward.
Again, it's not about them. It's not about what they want you to do. You need to understand, you know, your pain. You need to allow yourself to feel that pain, and allow yourself to have a process of an individual process to see where it leads. And again, you can't make someone forgive. You know, if a greasy or a spouse who has cheated is extremely, extremely apologetic and is very, very remorseful, that doesn't mean that you have to forgive them. It's really a personal process. Yes, would it
David?
Be? Yes.
Can I tell you a span in the works?
Sure.
It depends, I think, on the culture and other things. If you take, for instance, my background from a Christian society, from a faith point of view, if a person asks forgiveness, you are obliged to forgive them. Right. You can't hold out and say, I'm not going to forgive you. So it's not within, you know, you may feel hurt, but you don't have the right. If they don't ask forgiveness, you're entitled to stay upset. But if a person asks forgiveness, you are obliged to forgive them.
And I think that's true, if I stand corrected, for the Jewish religion as well. You know, if someone asks you, I think, how it is, it three times?
A number of times.
You have to say that you forgive them. Mm. And I think for me, that is, from a religious point of view, I think there is pressure then to give up that, to give up that anger. And I'm saying, I think there is a lot of pressure to do that, as you're saying, Luba, from religion, from maybe society. You know, apartheid was so long ago. But it's a very personal process. It's a, you know,
it is. I think where it goes wrong is that what I find, particularly in this country, is that people tend to throw that up front. Say, for instance, we take a scenario where somebody's loved one is murdered, and then you hear the relative, the mother, the husband saying, oh, no, I forgive them. But the person hasn't asked forgiveness. So I sometimes find that pressure from a religious point of view puts so much pressure on people that they almost throw forgiveness even before the other person has actually said, I'm remorseful for what I did. And that's where then I think you just go nowhere, because you've got one who said, I forgive, and they haven't actually even processed what has happened for them to forgive.
Yeah, and I think there's a combination of South Africanisms as well as a largely Christian base, is that we're so quick to forgive. We want to rush to forgive so that we can quickly move on. And I think that that's been part of our problem in South Africa.
I think so. You know, I think we need to make a distinction between an emotional, intellectual decision to forgive someone. As we've been saying, that's a very personal process. But very importantly, we're not saying that if you don't forgive, it gives you carte blanche to be destructive. It gives you carte blanche to attack other people. It's certainly not. It's just that you're not ready to allow yourself to let go of that anger. But certainly it doesn't mean that anger can be placed, or imposed on other people in a destructive and negative manner. So again, it's very important that we take responsibility when we are not ready, or we decide consciously that we cannot forgive or that we're not ready to forgive, that it doesn't give us entitlement to then, if we've been abused, to abuse other people. We need to take responsibility for our process, and that's also very important.
Since I'm lying on the couch here, then let me throw this at you. The challenge then with South Africa is, what do you do when you're dealing with hurt, let's say corporate hurt amongst people, and many of whom don't recognize it? So I've always said, if you look at this at race in South Africa, part of the problems come from the generations of hurt in the black community, many of whom will not openly recognize that they feel that hurt, there is that hurt, and people want to pretend all is fine. And as long as you're walking with that hurt you haven't dealt with, you're not in a good place. You will lash out, you will react very strongly. But the problem is the corporate kind of hurt, and it's very difficult for people to deal with, because there's a personal hurt and there's also the corporate one. But by the large, people want to pretend that it's not there. Mm-hmm. And that is my problem, is that it's almost healing that people need to go through. But if you're denying the hurt, that you actually feel hurt and that you have been hurt, and then you're not in a place to, you know, to move forward. And that for me is a problem.
Which is really, David, what we were saying earlier, is that it's a big issue when people, I'm sure in your world, when somebody comes and says, "No, I've let it go, I've forgiven A, B, C, or D," but in fact, really, as Luba's saying, they actually haven't. They are just not able to recognize it. How do you go through a process of actually forgiving and not just saying? Because saying it, even saying it and meaning it at the time, is very, very different to saying it, meaning it at the time, and then a week later, just finding yourself caught up in that negative, recurring feeling of anger and disappointment.
It's a very difficult, long, often long and arduous process. It's not something that happens overnight. It's very painful. It's almost like a loss, a death. Mm. You have to get...
Because you're on mourning, even if you've stayed with the spouse in that example, even if you continue to live in South Africa and build forward, you've still lost what was.
Right. Exactly. And I think again, it's not something, you know, people say too flippantly, "I forgive you." And again, it leads to difficulty, because we then, in some ways, if we have announced it, then we have to give up our anger when we really still feel very angry. So I think it's so important. And I think to Luba's point, that it does help when the person who has, wronged you, or, who has done the wrong thing, is more apologetic, is wanting to apologize.
Right, it does make it easier to forgive.
It certainly does. So in, you know.
So in that way, their remorse is relevant.
Well, I think absolutely. And I think, Luba's example of maybe corporate South Africa saying, you know, "We haven't done anything wrong," or, you know, "Really, there's nothing that we have to apologize for," does put a spanner in the works. It's very, very difficult, or more difficult, to forgive someone who's completely denying the reality than someone who accepts it and is apologizing and is truly remorseful.
Howard, on a personal level, I've found that, you know, I've sat with many couples over the last 20 years whose marriages have been in trouble. And my experience has been that you need to get, you know, the offending party to apologize and to express remorse. But strangely, this may sound bizarre to some, I've often found that trawling through the details gets you nowhere. So I've always found that sometimes you need the person to recognize that the action was wrong and to agree on principles on how they should conduct themselves rather than a detailed inquiry into every single, you know, errant step they took. But the challenge with forgiveness is that one person thinks that they'll find closure in hearing every minute detail. And the other person doesn't really want to, you know, bare their soul and relive their past sins either.
Mistake.
But it's a strange balance that I think personally what's worked for me is to say to people, how should you be conducting yourselves in this relationship, in this marriage? And what's the ideal and how do we make sure that that's how you live by rather than simply saying, let's do an interrogation and go backwards.
Right.
But that's the challenge is that the victim often wants to hear the gory detail, and when they come out, it depresses them even more.
Even further.
It's so interesting because, you know, our precious Desmond Tutu said, I found this quote very useful, is that forgiveness says you're given another chance to make a new beginning. So really, I think that's very profound because it's really about saying things have happened in the past and they are, and yes.
See, I don't like that one bit. I find that I'm sorry, no offense to you or Desmond,
but
I find that simplistic because you're not starting a new beginning. You're the same person in the same relationship in the example that I'm using. It's not a new beginning.
So I agree with you completely, but it gives you, so maybe a new beginning is a
opportunity.
So maybe we need to say an opportunity to start something new,
yes,
something different.
Well, yes, interesting. Mark Uber says, in Jewish tradition, repentance means returning to the path of justice. It means when faced with the same challenge again, you will act differently. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's the question. If we're looking at an Agrizi, faced with the same situation, do we believe that he would do the same or wouldn't he?
Such a good point. It's a very
you
good
know,
point.
Temptation is always dressed up very nicely. That's the problem. Whether it's money or spouse strain, that's the problem. It's easy to say a person would act differently, but you know, whatever causes the person to stumble, be it a financial, the fraud or in a relationship, it's never something horrible by the looks of it. So it's, you know, nobody's saying be poor. Somebody's offering you money. And that's the challenge is you're really speaking to a person's moral compass. Which can it stand the pressure of something very appealing, financial or whatever, that's saying, you know, just stray a little bit off the course.
Interesting. Mark says, in therapy I do, we do this all in one session. It requires emptying out of all stored pain, and that's the feeling, not the story. So that goes to what you're saying, Luba. You're pouring out the feeling, not the story.
Yes.
Vocally, in consciousness, it happens at a soul level and not at an ego level. David, would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And what I would say is that I would say that it's unlikely that it could all be resolved within one session. Everyone's different. It's a process. And I think looking at the discussion we've had this morning, we can see the complexities of it. We can see that this is not something that can be resolved by a statement, I forgive.
That's the important thing is, and that's what I'm getting out of it. We can't just say it. It really is a process and we've really got to look into it ourselves, feel our anger, feel our pain, feel our disappointment. And in South African context, feel our loss because we're sitting in tremendously difficult times
and I think
because of what happened. And we don't need to let that. We need to let that go?
I think Luba's point is so important is that when we look at actions after the apology or the actions after someone has been caught or has come forward and admitted what they've done, that also plays a role and I think also helps us to decide consciously, unconsciously, whether we can forgive or not. So I think that also plays a role. So when we talk about Agrizi, I think right now, maybe a lot of people are not ready to forgive him. But let's see his actions from now.
It's a journey.
It's a journey. Let's see how he conducts himself moving forward. And I think that will inform a lot of feeling around forgiveness.
Absolutely.
Howard?
Yes, sir.
What mischief have you guys been getting up to Joburg?
Wow, what have we done now?
You've got pastors buying debts and you're resurrecting people from the dead.
Aren't Cape Townians doing that? You know, but people are being resurrected all over the show in Johannesburg. It's the latest craze right now.
You know, if I can just make a comment on that, what worries me is this. As a nation, I think we're impatient. It speaks in some ways to, it might answer why people are so easy to bribe and corrupt. You get a sense in South Africa and in Africa that there's a sense of urgency in not wanting to go through the steps to achieve certain things, and therefore we're prepared to take the shortcut. So, I mean, a lot of these guys are promising riches, and people are flocking to these places of worship because they're promised that, come here, put in a bit of money, you'll become a millionaire. And people aren't prepared to sit and say, I'm going to slog and work a good number of years and have a quality of life. That's the sad part.
Mm. It is. It's tremendous. Yeah, you're dealing with people at their most vulnerable, aren't you?
Mm. Absolutely.
Yeah, it is. It's an absolutely absurd thing. The only thing positive about it is on Twitter, they've had this whole resurrection challenge, and it is very, very funny. It is South Africans at their best. It is 8:54.